welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I am Brian Feetz, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we are in minute 17 now already. And this is, it's just us. It's just us chickens here today.
Our guests are each other.
Yes.
So everybody be nice to everybody.
Yeah, treat each other nicely. Exactly. Yes.
Wow. Well, we do have I would say this, I mean, there's not a lot going on in this minute, but there's a lot of things to talk about in the midst of it all. So,
Al contraire, my friend, I think this is one of the most important minutes, and I'll tell you why as soon as we get the synopsis.
Stand by and stay tuned. So, Hal, would you enlighten us what's going on here in the 17th minute of the movie?
I'll be happy to. Dr. Abraham Erskine leans back, studying Steve Rogers with a probing gaze in the dim light of the exam room. "This troubles you?" he asks, his voice low, referring to their talk of Nazis and war. "No," Steve replies, his tone steady, blue eyes meeting Erskine's without flinching. Erskine's lips twitch, intrigued. "Where are you from, Mr. Rogers? Is it New Haven or Paranus? 5 exams in 5 different cities." Steve shifts, a flicker of unease crossing his face. "That might not be the right file." "No, it's not the exams I'm interested in. It's the 5 tries," Erskine cuts in, his voice sharp but warm. "But you didn't answer my question. Do you want to kill Nazis?" Steve's brow furrows. "Is this a test?" "Yes," Erskine says simply, his eyes never leaving Steve's. Steve exhales, his voice firm but earnest. "I don't want to kill anyone. I don't like bullies. I don't care where they're from." Erskine nods slowly, a spark of approval in his gaze. "Well, there are already so many big men fighting this war. Maybe what we need now is a little guy." He pauses, leaning forward. "I can offer you a chance. Only a chance." "I'll take it," Steve says without hesitation, his jaw set. Erskine's smile widens, genuine now. "Good. So where is the little guy from, actually?" There we are.
Lovely job.
Proper German, yes. I do have to stand up and defend as a native of the Garden State. I do have to stand up for Paramus, New Jersey, because it was a nice little town and a great mall. Back in the 70s, going to the Paramus Mall was an event. I saw Leonard Nimoy there. So oh, wow. To me,
there you go.
Was he at an appearance, or was he just in the wild?
Yeah, he had an appearance there. I think, if I remember correctly, the name of the store was Abraham and Strauss, and he was at an Abraham and Strauss store making an appearance. And I think it was promoting a book. It wasn't. It was post Spock. So yeah. And it was.
He did photography. Was it photography?
It was. It might have been poetry. He was.
Oh.
He was,
oh yeah, I had that book.
Yeah, I Am Not Spock and all that. Yeah, he was signing books.
I remember Spock. And then later he did one. I Am Spock.
Yes.
Yes. Turns out I was Spock after all.
With the hey, look, no. I'm Spock. It turns out I'm Spock. Yeah.
Then followed by who is this Spock fellow anyway?
And then still Spock
after all these years.
Spock again.
Enough with the Spock already. Yeah.
Revenge of the Spock.
But Paramus remains a great town there in Bergen County, and I will not let it be besmirched, no matter what Dr. Erskine thinks of it.
I don't think anybody's besmirching it. I think but.
One of the most beautiful drives I've ever taken. It was mainly because it was my first sort of adult experience with fall color, because I lived so much of my life in the Pacific Northwest in the Evergreen State, so I wasn't used to these crazy explosions of color. But I was I remember what it was. I was out, maybe it was Atlantic City or they may have been actually heading up to New York, but I was on the New Jersey Turnpike in the fall. And it was just a long, straight highway, that section of it. But I couldn't get over the explosion of colors in the trees. And I was looking around. I was like, wait a minute, this is New Jersey? This is not living up to the stereotype at all.
Well, the Garden State it is. So,
there you go. Lovely. Anyway.
So I had some thoughts on the minute. Okay. I've been in New Jersey once, and I went to Princeton, and it was lovely. But I think this is a key minute in this movie. The dialogue between Erskine and Steve, is this a test? Yes. I don't want to kill anyone. I don't like bullies. I think that's as pure a distillation of MCU Captain America's character as you could imagine. I think this says more about him than I could do this all day. Those two sentences, you know, I don't want to kill anyone. I don't like bullies. That encapsulates Steve's moral code that guides him through all the stories that follow. When he says those words, that's when you fall in love with this kid, I think.
That's a great point. And it's made all the more powerful coming on that foundation, that reminder that he's been trying to enlist. You know, he's had his five tries. He's trying to do this. He's trying to. And now, as you say, we sort of crack the code. And here's why. And it does. It tells you exactly who he is. And we know we're not going to see, you know, we're not going to see a bloodthirsty, you know, sort of revenge movie or anything like that. We're going to see somebody who's just doing his best to do the right thing for the right reasons.
Yeah. And as Erskine will tell Steve later, you know, the reason he's the ideal candidate is he has been bullied. He's been on the other side of the bullying,
right.
And he doesn't like bullies. And none of the other super soldier candidates who are going to show up in that training camp have had that experience.
Yeah, it's like it would be so easy for him to become just using another another line of superheroes. It's so easy for him to become a Homelander, where yes. You know, it's basically I have this power and I will abuse whoever I want to. And he's not that kind of guy. And Erskine, as we will find out later, Erskine has been exposed to that mentality. So it's a nice foreshadowing, not of, you know, Steve's destiny, but also the destiny of his foes. It's really nice how it builds up from here. And like you said, even though this is a small scene, it's so critical to understanding the nature of what drives Rogers.
Well, and Bolt builds up and carries through all the way to the end when he's the last man standing against Thanos. This is that guy, you know. This is his mission statement as much as truth, justice, and the American way is Superman's mission statement.
Hear, hear. And
yeah.
You know, he remembers, as you said, he knows what it's like to be bullied, and he will always remember what it's like to be the 90-pound weakling, you know, getting the sand kicked in his face at the beach and, you know, that sort of thing from those ads. Brian, as our resident well-read comic person, was Erskine the character in the comics, or was he a creation for the film?
No, he was definitely, he wasn't as well fleshed out. I mean, Stanley Tucci did an amazing job with him. But there was a, I think in the original comic, like in the 40s, he was Professor Reinstein because they couldn't use Einstein. but in very short order, he became Dr. Erskine. I don't know if they give him the first name Abraham in the comics. That might have been just for the movie. Did not pre-research this question, but he was definitely there. He played the same sort of role as the paternal mad scientist turned good, you know, fighting for our side. And Stanley, I just can't say enough good things about how Stanley Tucci played this character. He's such a fine line between sort of amusement and bemusement and, you know, support for Steve and being that father he didn't have. And it's just a lovely performance.
And Tucci's such a chameleon too. You know, he's one of those guys that I can't think of anything where I would have called him a leading man necessarily, but I think he could have gone that route if he wanted to, but you just sort of, you see him in something and it's like, oh my gosh, that's him. And he's going to be great in this too. He's like, it's always a pleasant, not a pleasant surprise necessarily, but it's always a pleasure to see him pop up in anything.
He feels like the Alan Arkin of the movie. I mean, we're going to do referencing Rocketeer and things like that. He has that. He is such a great support role. I mean, I recently rewatched the film that he did about Julia Child, where he played Julia Child's husband.
Yep.
And he dissolves himself into that character, and you stop thinking of him as, you know, Stanley Tucci's doing this, but He does great to let other people shine in his scenes, but he's still, you know, just you can feel his character down to his bones in this short time that he's on screen in this thing. He adds so much to the film.
Well, you talk about him being a chameleon actor, and I that reminds me of someone like Gary Oldman, who just disappears into a role.
Yes.
And you know, uses whatever accent is needed and does it flawlessly. I remember watching this movie, Captain America: First Avenger, with my wife, who's a big Stanley Tucci fan, and we were fairly far past this point in the movie when she kind of looks over at me and says, "Is that Stanley Tucci?" And she's a fan, but he so became this Erskine character that it took her a few minutes to figure it out.
I was just saying, going back to Erskine, the character, and or as you say, Reinstein, which really made me laugh in the comics and things. I think it was a smart move. It makes his role all the more pivotal. Excuse me, and I know there's some foreshadowing here, but that he is, he was German and he got out, things like that. I think this character, in whatever incarnation, whatever medium, would have just been flat and not have the authority if he didn't have that background. If he were just from some guy from that, well, Paramus, for want of a better location, if he were working at Jim's Mall over there, it would have been okay. You could have delivered some of the same lines and things. But you get a sense that he understands something about this war that most of the rest of the country at this point does not.
This is probably, it is trivia, but this is all trivia. So, but he talked about 5 different exams in different cities. And he said, is it New Haven or Paramus? Mm. We also know that he signed up in his home borough of Brooklyn. And now we're assuming that he's in Flushing Meadow talking, this is the Queens. World Exhibition is in Queens. I just want to know where the fifth place was, because it had to have been New Haven to Paramus is far apart from each other. I mean, New Haven is the south center of Connecticut, and Paramus is over the river in New Jersey. But I think it shows that, here this 98-pound weakling is doing everything he can. We don't know what kind of a job he has or any, maybe doing scrap metal like he keeps talking about. But he's obviously wandering far away just to see if he can find some way he can sneak into the army.
Yeah, I think he put his nickels together and, caught a train or caught a bus,
There are scenes where there's a scene with Bucky talking to him who is, and Bucky knows about these multiple attempts. And I was trying to recall, I should have perfect and total recall of every word in this film. And I do not, but I thought there was a thing where Bucky was sort of teasing him about, are you so-and-so from here? Are you so-and-so from there? Yeah. But I don't recall if he was listing actual examples or just sort of, making things up, knowing that Steve had tried all of these.
Yeah, he did say Jersey, but I don't remember if it was it was Paramus, New Jersey. I'm not sure, but I will look back into previous episodes and see if he did happen to mention something like that. But yeah, I mean, the economy of the script is always impressive that he can leave these. It feels well thought out. These scenes don't look like they thought of it while they were doing. This is again this typical Joe Johnston thing that. He has a good idea, like having a character speaking Norwegian, he will make that change. But it looks like once the script is in, he's locked on it, and then he just goes with it for there.
Another point of the scene that impressed me that passes without notice as it should is what a wonderful job, as we discussed in other episodes, of the the effects team did here.
Oh, God.
Because they've got Skinny Steve, they've got Chris Evans on site, and they've got Stanley Tucci. And as we've learned from other people who worked on these movies, they shoot each scene, 3 different times and maybe more than 3 times to get those characters interacting right with against the background plate and so forth, keep the eyesight lines going. And when it's as well done as it is in this minute, all you see is Dr. Erskine talking to Skinny Steve, and it's just beautifully done.
Right. You never think about it. And I'm hard pressed to, we certainly live well into the era of effects films and big spectacles and things. And you see big over the top effects and stuff. And it's almost to the point now where some movie comes out and, the tsunami is wiping out the city or the meteor is hitting or whatever else. And it's like, ho hum. Yeah, that looks realistic. Okay. you know, great. We're so used to that. But then you see something like this that is, you know, purposely meant to be unnoticed. As you said, Brian, it goes without notice quite properly. And it's staggering. I'm hard to press to think of other examples. You know, we see some, you know, with no Uncanny Valley. I don't think there's a second of that in this film with Skinny Steve. You know, we Rogue One, we've got Tarkin and Leia, and those things are sort of up for debate. They have different impacts on different people and things like that. But people notice it, they frown at it, and they call it out and they talk about it. And this, it's just like, oh, this guy's
that's the world,
pretty small. Yeah. And then later he's really buff. And
you know, a comparison that occurs to me, and I don't know if you'd agree or disagree, is the Lord of the Rings movies with all the hobbits. You know, those actors were all, you know, 5.5, 6 feet tall, and they made them look like they were half that. And it was pulled off really well. You just accept that this is the world and those are the characters, and nicely done.
Yeah. By the way, I just wanted to let our faithful listeners who are probably yelling at their, you know, on their Pelotons or out walking their dogs or things like that, back in minute 11, as Hal so aptly acted, Bucky does mention, how many times is this? You're from Paramus now? You know, it's illegal to lie on your enlistment form. And seriously, Jersey? So he does mention Paramus gets two mentions in this movie. So go Bergen County.
And there's your diss of Jersey. The diss of Jersey came from Bucky, not Erskine or Steve.
Yeah. Well, he laid the groundwork for it. So I don't know.
He did indeed. Yeah. Well, thank you for closing that that loop, Jim.
We can all breathe easier.
Look at us. We're making mistakes and fixing them in the same podcast.
In real time.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. It is, isn't it?
Wow. I think I keep wondering, you know, we forgot to ask. We've been talking about the World's Fair as we are wont to do. but I was wondering if in the 39 World's Fair, was there an Army recruitment center? Does anybody know whether? I didn't.
I tried to look that up and found nothing. It wasn't a big enough deal to put in the publicity.
Yeah, I couldn't find anything. I was looking through the 1940. I have a 1940 World's Fair souvenir book, but I couldn't find anything related to that other than there. You know, there was a United States Pavilion thing, but nothing specific to the military. Of course, you know, if you're in New York City, all you have to do is go to Times Square, and right in the middle of Times Square is a gigantic recruitment center.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised. On the other hand, Pearl Harbor hadn't happened yet. So although, what year is the Stark Expo? Is the Stark Expo 42?
43.
So Pearl Harbor had happened. So
yeah,
it's a different world.
We're already past Midway. So
yeah. So it makes a lot of sense there'd be a recruitment center there.
Yeah, what I'm not sure is how, I wonder what the recruitment level was versus the draft level by 1943, what the people enlisting were doing at the time. So maybe a future episode we can talk
about. I bet we can dig into that in a future episode. I know a guy.
Stay tuned. any other further thoughts on this particular minute? It's difficult when we can't interrogate. I guess we have to actually talk about the movie.
I would just close with the same thought I began with, which is I think this is narratively a very important part in the character development of Steve Rogers. It's the point where, as I said before, I don't want to belabor it, but he makes his mission statement. And you know, that's sincere and right to the core of his being. And I think that's the moment Erskine looks at him and just says, "You're my boy." And he'll carry that out for many movies to come.
And, you know, jumping ahead just a little bit, when we do see the other candidates, you know, other than our buddy Gilmore Hodge that we'll be talking to down the road, we don't really get to know the other candidates very well. I think Hodge is the one who stands in stark contrast, no pun intended, to Steve. And he's the one who, you know, so reinforcing it further. It's like, we know who Steve is from this minute, as you pointed out, Brian. And then we see somebody like Hodge, you know, that's who we might think would be a candidate for the super soldier. He's sort of rough and tumble and cocky and, you know, ready to go. But it, you know, I do find myself being very curious about, okay, what was the selection process for the other guys, the other half dozen or whatever it was.
Did Erskine have a say in all of those? Or it, to me, the backstory, the way that Erskine was kind of jumping in and out of all this, it seemed like he didn't have much of a say, letting Tommy Lee Jones's character figure out what was going on with most of them.
I agree with you, because Erskine wouldn't have picked those other lunkheads and jarheads. But my impression is that Steve was kind of Erskine's pet project. Like, okay, we'll let you have this one. While I talk to these other 80 guys, one of who's going to be our super soldier, you can have your little pet side project.
Yeah, I think that's the way it was. He was looking for the diamond in the rough. Wow. Well, see this.
The very small diamond in the rough.
Yes. With a lot of special effects involved in giving size carrot. Anyway, well, this has been a great episode, and I'd like to thank our audience for joining us. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like the show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at our podcast streaming service, wherever you found this particular episode. Please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and our possible guests. So please join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.